Continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. When I was a kid, I was a big fan of In Search Of, the TV show narrated by Leonard Nimoy that went that looked at weird stuff like Yetis and UFOs and the mysterious Nazca lines in Peru. And so I was a big fan of that kind of paranormal stuff. And then there started to be movies that were kind of running with that same mid-70s paranormal material. And one of my favorites was In Search of Noah's Ark, 1977. I was 10 years old. I remember going to this. And, they made the argument that Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat. And they had their sort of goofy pseudoscientific evidence, which I wasn't particularly interested in one way or the other at the time. I think, like a lot of people who consume that material, I was kind of more interested in the mythic shock and the fact that some people seem to actually believe it just gave it more charge. It was just more enjoyable. It wasn't like I became a believer. But that movie also included some reenactment scenes, of Noah getting ready for the flood and the animals and all that. And it really initiated a fascination that continues with the sort of representation of biblical reality inside of documentaries. There's this weird kind of mind frame you get into as you watch this stuff, where you're watching, let's say, a documentary and they're making some claim about what the ancient world was like or the ancient Israelis were like or the Exodus or whatever it is. And then you come to the reenactment thing, and you're watching, and you're like, well, "Is this a what is this? Is this like? Do they believe that this is what actually happened? Are they narrating a myth? Is this a fantasy?" And it gets into that weird reality, false reality, kind of zone that reality TV does today, because it's really this ongoing question within documentaries and indeed a lot of mainstream writing about the history of the Bible and the material in the New Testament and the Old Testament, which is that on the one hand, people want to be critical about it, show what's actually true. It's a documentary. You're saying, what do we actually know about these guys back in the day? Can we really say anything about King David? Can we really say anything about Jesus or Paul or St. John the Baptist or whatever? And at the same time, people watching these things, just the same way like I did when I was a kid, want to believe, or at least want to become kind of get up close and snuggle with belief. And so there's this weird dialectic in a lot of this material between a critical view and a kind of embrace of the story as if it were true. And of course, this speaks to this fundamental divide in modern society about the reality of the Bible. Is it a literal document? Is it telling a history? Most of us have left that one in the dust. But then, a quarter of the population of the United States believes that it's literally true. Exactly what that means, it's hard to tell. One of my favorite books that I own, actually, and I got it when I was briefly a born-again Christian in high school, which is another story, and it's called Dake's Annotated Reference Bible, and it's a fundamentalist Bible. And so what the references do is they try to construct what it would mean to really take the text literally, which means that when they describe like things that angels do, for example, there's like a list in one of the note annotations. This is like what we know about angels. It's like angels eat food, angels have a body, and it's all based on little elements that are scattered throughout the whole book. And so it's a very strange and marvelous text, because it literally marvelous in the sense that by trying to literally interpret the Bible, that everything is straight up, there's as little metaphoric language as you can get away with. Of course, there's always some metaphors. They're not going to say everything in it is literal, which is, of course, part of the problem. But by saying, how literally can we take this text, it actually builds up this incredibly fabulous, bizarre story, because they're not treating as metaphors what even most strongly believing Christians would treat as metaphors. So it kind of loops back around, going from the sort of fantastic to the literal to the even more fantastic. So this remains like a fundamental dynamic in our contemporary sense of the Bible, which, of course, continues to have an incredibly powerful effect on America, for sure, even if the elites and the media no longer are quite as influenced or under the thumb of biblical authority, there it still remains an incredibly powerful aspect of our life. And our guest today, Richard Smoley, has just written a new book called How God Became God, What Scholars Are Really Saying About God in the Bible, which dives into this issue of what contemporary scholarship is saying about the reality of the Bible and how to think about that. Not so much just like, here's what they're saying, but what are the consequences of this? How do people avoid the consequences? How do they think about them creatively? How do they think about them less creatively? And for those of you who are not familiar, Richard Smoley is really a wonderful writer and a great resource. He was, you know, educated at Harvard and Oxford, and he could have gone on and become a super successful academic working in high-level scholarship, but instead he became more of a writer devoted to esoteric and mystical topics. He was an editor of note, the late great Gnosis magazine, and he's written, I think, over a dozen books since then. And they are some of them are quite remarkable. I haven't read them all, but I've read most of them because Richard combines again of a not only writing accessibly for people who are not interested in scholarship, but writing about scholarship and really doing the hard work so that you don't have to. But he also has a very balanced, practical, and to my mind, sane and very compelling take on the core value of esotericism and mysticism. So he's not interested in the wacky woo stuff. He's interested in what we can actually, how these things, you know, impact our lives, but also in a way that opens up to the mystery, to the possibilities of alternate dimensions in Kabbalah or mystical experiences of union with the Godhead, really taking the kind of pith of spiritual traditions seriously, but reframing them in an accessible modern guise, which is what he's done with the question of the reality of the Bible in terms of historical scholarship and belief today. So, with no further ado, Richard, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking, I think you're with the last time we talked was for the dice game of Shiva, which was quite a long time ago, and it makes me realize how long I've been doing this podcast.
That came out in 2009.
Yes. So it has been a while. So I was interested in the new book in terms of the topic. There have been, of course, waves over the years of various forms of this debate coming out in the public eye, where there's a new book about the historicity of Jesus that says we really don't know very much at all, and then we see maybe a kind of a religious reaction to that, and there's been these kind of waves of more or less critical thinking about the Bible, both the Old Testament and the events in the New Testament. And so you sort of decided to make this move now. What was it, you know, over the last few years or when you came to decide to write about this material, since it has been, you know, an ongoing story since the 19th century, the kind of historical and critical deconstruction of the reality of claims made in the Bible. What was it about the last few years or when you came to decide to write the book? What was going on in the culture that made you think, you know, it's actually time to look at this stuff again in a fresh way and offer my own perspective on it?
Well, the best entrance point into an answer goes back to something you said about many people having left the literal meaning of the Bible in the dust. And you're right. I think one poll recently said about 28% still believe of the U.S. population still believe in the literal truth of the Bible, you know, meaning arguably the other 72% don't. But when you get to this business about the Bible not being literally true, there is an enormous amount of confusion and simple vagueness. Now, most of the discussion tends to focus on Genesis, sometimes the flood, which is a fascinating story in its own right. But beyond that, people are very, and I'm talking about educated, literate people. You know, they believe they believe they've left this whole thing in the dust. But when it comes to, you know, actual details, well, what part, as you were saying about the story of David is true? What part of the story of Moses is true? Now, a lot of questions remain about all of this. And then and the problem of the historical Jesus, which has been occupying scholars for, I don't know, maybe 250 years, is another aspect of that. But you will find that most people have a default. Again, when I say most people in the context of this conversation, I'm talking about educated, literate people. I'm not talking, you know, about, shall we say, the unwashed, uneducated. I'm talking about the intelligentsia. There's really no clear concept about what parts of the Bible are true, you know, are factually, that is to say, factually, historically correct, and what parts aren't. And the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, there's just simply a lot of vagueness about it. With the New Testament, you do see an opposite reaction, and I see this on, you know, replies to posts on Facebook. There's suddenly become an enormous amount of skepticism about the existence of Jesus. Jesus was invented by, you know, some kind of committee created by Constantine the Great in 325 AD. Jesus was a fiction cooked up by Paul. Jesus was a composite hybrid God pulled together by some completely unknown committee in the first, second century, combining features of Horus and Adonis and Osiris and all the others. That is the mishmash of opinion that is out there. So my book, How God Became God, is at least an attempt to orient people toward current scholarly opinion about both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, and at least give them a framework for understanding where the discussion is. And also, well, it turns out that a lot of the Bible is not literally true. And we can discuss that in as much detail as you like. So then what are you going to do with it if it isn't? You know, as you say, leave it in the dust, or does it still have some value in some sort of way? So those were the things that inspired me to write How God Became God. Hello?
One of the old things about the Old Testament that's really interesting, if we start out talking about the Old Testament, is that it combines, you know, clearly mythic cosmological stories, the story of the creation of the earth, and then these powerful, almost folktale-like tales in the Pentateuch, in the first five books of the Bible, and then as we march forward. We get towards things that seem more and more like normal histories of kings and wars and abductions and all this sort of stuff. And eventually we're actually at a point where the stories we're reading about are about the time period when the texts themselves were roughly being written. So it kind of, you know, it's confusing as a historical document, in part because there's parts of it that are so clearly historically written and rooted in the history of the times when the texts themselves were being written. And yet there's also, it goes back in time to things that are much more mythological. How do you start to work with that? Is there a point where things really shift and the material starts to seem more historically grounded? Is it run through and through with elements of fact, and how does archaeology, let's say, help illuminate that distinction?
The short answer to your question is 850 BC. That is roughly the point at which the historical Old Testament begins to come into focus. By the time of the 7th century, when a good part of the Bible was written or starting to be written, it becomes in sharper focus still. Now, 850 BC may seem a curious date to choose, but it is roughly the date of wicked King Ahab, of the Northern Kingdom of Israel, whose wife Jezebel is much better known than he is. Ahab is the first Israelite king of whom there is any substantial record. What does that mean in the archaeology? What does that mean? Well, his stables were unearthed in Samaria, in northern Palestine or Israel or whatever you like to call it. There is a stele. A stele is a carved standing stone with inscriptions written in it, often with historical information, usually of a chronicle type. And a particular king at this point, not an Israelite king, says he went up to war against a coalition led by Ahab of Israel, who had 10,000 foot soldiers and 2,000 chariots, which was a lot. And of course, this king who carved this said he'd won, although this king also happened to have to go back to his native country very soon thereafter, meaning that Ahab probably won. Now, that is when it starts to come into focus. For example, around last December, there was a seal discovered of a biblical king called a king of Judah, the southern kingdom, Hezekiah. How does this fit in to what I've been talking about? It fits perfectly. Hezekiah reigned around 700 BC, which is later than 850 BC, which is, as I said, the part of the Bible that starts to become historical. So that is a reasonable cutoff date. Now, that cutoff date, on the other end of that cut, aside of that cutoff date, is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, let's set aside the Genesis and flood stories, because that's almost another topic. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the Exodus, Moses, King David, King Solomon, all of those things are on the less historical half of this continuum. So that is roughly where it goes. And the later it gets past 850, the more historical it gets. Although there's an enormous amount of prophetic and apocalyptic material as well. It's all not all historical.
You know, one question I've always had is, how important is the sort of literal historical claims of the Bible to contemporary Jews? And I know that there's conservative, reformed, and orthodox. There's already many flavors of Judaism, and I'm sure and I know that they treat things very differently. But you know, from looking at it from a Christian point of view, it's really clear in American fundamentalism how important the literal truth of the Bible is. Like, just the very idea that the Bible is literally true, that it's 6,000 years, is an incredibly important part of the dynamics of faith. How is that true within contemporary Jewish communities? Like, how important is the idea that there really was an Abraham? Is there more room for different kinds of interpretation? Is it only in the Orthodox that we find that kind of literalism?
Well, what I'm going to say is very tentative, for the simple reason that I'm not a Jew, and I don't really feel it's my place, you know, to give any sort of authoritative comment on Judaism. My impression is that there is the same continuum that, the Orthodox, believe, or at least the ultra-Orthodox believe in, the story as it is given. And, you get down to the more liberal side where people kind of realize that a lot of it isn't literally true, although, as I would say for the mainstream non-Jews, what parts are true and what parts aren't true are not very clear. So I think there's the same continuum. And the idea that there is a symbolical or allegorical meaning to much of the Bible is accepted. But I don't think there's an enormous amount of clarity there on the subject among Jews either.
Well, one of the stories that you tell in How God Became God isn't just about the way that other scholars are dealing with the questions of the historicity of things in the Bible, but also your own story about that. I mean, meaning that you're constructing a narrative about how the idea of God evolved. And one of the important points that you bring up in terms of the Old Testament and that framework is actually there's sort of different names for God, and it's not actually clear that when people were using them initially or when the texts that used these different names are really referring to the same being or not. In retrospect, you say, oh, it's all God, but maybe they were actually talking about different kinds of beings. So could you go back to some of that early stuff, particularly the difference between the God El and the God named Yahweh, because that kind of sets up one of the story you're telling about how these notions evolved into Christianity and beyond.
Well, to sum up a complicated story as briefly as I can, the Israelite religion was probably not very different from the Canaanite religion at the outset. I'm talking about like 1500 BC. And the high Canaanite god was named El. He was like the king of the gods. And there were deputy gods that ruled around him. Now, it turns out that there was an idea of national gods. That is, a particular people made a covenant with a particular god who was, shall we say, subordinate to El, but whom that people was supposed to worship. And what seems to have happened is that the Israelites around, say, the 13th century BC kind of came together around a covenant with Yahweh, who was one of these subordinate gods. And the conventional picture, and I think it's probably more or less sound, is that the Jews were not necessarily, Hebrews were not necessarily monotheistic to begin with. They were what's sometimes called henotheistic or monolatrous, meaning there were a lot of gods, but they only worshipped one. And the tension between being supposed to worship this one god and being able or worshiping all sorts of other gods who happen to be around is, in a sense, what is probably the main drama of the Old Testament. Now, by about the 6th century BC, there was a movement. We don't know how old it is. It may go back centuries. It may have been quite new. That identified Yahweh, the Israelite national god, with El, the high god. And so you will see a statement in the Bible. You come across this thing in the Bible that says, the Lord is God. What an incredibly dull statement. Why even say it? It's redundant and certainly not the slightest bit interesting. But that's not what it says in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, it says Yahweh, usually translated as Lord, is El, usually translated as God. So in a sense, that was a radical, to say that Yahweh is El was a very, very radical theological statement. And that happened to be the side that won the struggle in Judaism. So that is, a very, very brief and sketchy history of, I think the question that you were asking me.
Yeah, what I love about that, and I really like that thread of your book, and then what you do with it later, which is an even more complicated story about the Son of Man and Jesus, and maybe we can touch on that briefly later. But in any case, what I really love about it is I always think it's really key when you start to bring in history to the discussion of religion, which I very much do. I approach things not exclusively historically, but largely historically, is it doesn't mean like, oh, well, we just talk about what we can talk about, what we know in terms of archaeology or what we know in terms of the politics of the time, et cetera, et cetera. But it's insisting that gods, whatever they are, they're the weird mix of story, psychology, maybe cosmic dimension, who knows, people's desire, that those things evolve and change through time. They grow, they die, they split, they fornicate, they mutate, and there's something really rich about using history as you do, not just to deconstruct, but also to kind of show the evolving life of these categories, these names, and to some extent, these beings, if we want to grant them at least some kind of being, history can actually really get you more intimate with some of these processes rather than being something I think a lot of believers or people who are interested in approaching these texts as, you know, profound sources of meaning, they're very wary of that kind of history because it seems to be taking away the juice. To my mind, it actually kind of makes things juicier. They're more interesting, especially when you get into the resonances between different traditions and then across time, the way you talk about how, let's say, medieval Kabbalah really is drawing from elements that are already in the Old Testament that go along, that only make sense in light of these ways. So there's a kind of play between history and myth that becomes quite rich, and that's in a way a long way of leading up to, let's shift the topic to the great myth, the great being of Jesus. And you do something interesting too, is that if I catch your intent here, on the one hand, you are interested in bringing forward the scholarship that makes us recognize the way in which Jesus is a partly fabricated figure, that it's very difficult to say what is true, what is not true, what we can even say, or what were the kinds of statements that if there was a Jesus, he probably said. So you have some of that historical criticism going on, but you're also critical of this kind of new spirit of demythifying that you referred to earlier, where, oh, Jesus is just an invention, he's a fiction, they invented him in the 4th century, it's just an amalgamation of these other gods and myths. You're like, no, there's a core narrative here. There's something that you're also interested in defending about the historicity of Jesus. And I'm curious how you sort of found your way through that, you know, that sort of tension between deconstructing the given myth of Jesus Christ as it's been built up in contemporary Christianity or modern Christianity, while also respecting a kind of core historical story there and not and resisting the kind of total deconstruction of the thing.
Right. Well, if you throw out the whole thing of Jesus, the whole idea of Jesus, and most, by the way, most of the things, the accounts that I'm criticizing are guilty of this. What you have to do, and I'm speaking purely, this has nothing to do with faith, right? We're talking about historical evidence. What you end up doing almost often, almost always rather, is they are discarding huge amounts of primary source material that they do have and completely inventing primary source material that for which there is no existence whatsoever. Now, let me take this in a very concrete way. Many kind of the trendy kind of liberal intellectual mainstream views that Jesus was a political agitator who fell afoul of the Romans, which is why he was crucified. Now, this has some serious historical problems because the oldest sources and the plurality of sources, in fact, almost all sources, say that was not the case. Jesus was a religious or spiritual teacher who infuriated the priests by infuriated the priests by assailing their corruption, and as a result, they managed to contrive to get him killed by the Romans. And as the Gospels say, the wicked Roman procurator Pontius Pilate. Governor, say, Pontius Pilate, couldn't care less about whether Jesus lived or not, saw him as no threat whatsoever, and just said, all right, well, if you insist. That is what the Gospels say. And that fits in with our source material. The core narrative of the Gospels, I would say, is sound. There was a man named Jesus. He taught and did certain things. And he irritated the religious authorities. I'm sorry, there have been some technical things. That's why we're I'm hemming and hawing here. There were authorities of his day who got him killed. That is all both perfectly plausible in the light of the times, and we know a lot about the times of Jesus. Compared to Old Testament times. So as a result, I think it's fair to say that the gospel narrative is basically sound. Now, there are a lot of things in there, a lot of details in there that are questionable. Why? Because every scholar, serious scholar, will say that there are some things in the Gospels. And let's stick with the Gospels of the New Testament just for simplicity's sake. Some of the things in there Jesus said and did, some of them he didn't say or do. Okay. Well, you are up against a very, very big problem at that point. Because how do you decide what he said or what he didn't say? Well, there are no external sources to judge against. There are no copies of the Jerusalem Daily Bugle from April 33 AD. There is nothing. And so, you know, your tending to exclude them has a great deal to do with your preconceptions about who Jesus was. And this, of course, is completely circular. You have this picture of Jesus. You cut out all the parts of the New Testament that don't fit your picture of Jesus. Voila, the New Testament, as modified by you, proves your view of Jesus. I mean, purely from, you know, an academic, logical, right? This is purely ludicrous. I know very few scholars of the New Testament who don't do this to some degree. And what does that mean? Well, it means one thing, that Jesus has become a Rorschach blot. I mean, he always sort of has been. But particularly for the more critical scholars, well, was Jesus a political revolutionary? Yeah, I think so. So by George, all that stuff he said must have been lost. Jesus was kind of a simple Zen-like religious teacher who never had a nasty word for anybody. So we have to junk all the stuff about him being nasty to the scribes and Pharisees and priests, in which case why they would want him to have him killed is completely mysterious. So what I'm saying is that a lot of this is waffling, no matter how learned and no matter how puffed up. I think we have to go and stick with the core narrative that there was this figure who preached the kingdom of heaven, something like the kingdom of heaven, who talked about the Son of Man, which is a long story in itself, was crucified. And I would go further and say his disciples had some experience or believe they experienced some encounters with him after he was dead. Now, having dead relatives and friends appear to you is remarkably common. You mentioned Gnosis, of which I was editor in the 90s. Well, we used to get all kinds of stories about people whose parents and whatnot had appeared to them after they died. I have a friend who said his father appeared to him after he died to tell him to make sure to wear a suit to the funeral.
I want to just underscore this because people who tend to be a little bit more skeptical about paranormal claims, you know, they kind of, I don't really want to hear it, but it's really incredible how consistent this particular kind of reporting is, both in the records and then in people's lives, that, you know, many, many people who don't have any other kinds of paranormal experience will attest to these kinds of dreams and sometimes visitations, sometimes visual impressions in the room or whatever. It's really quite remarkable part of human experience to how regular these appearances are. But go on.
Well, at this point, I'm only speaking phenomenologically. That is to say, what this really meant or what this implies about afterlife is not, up to this point, relevant. I'm saying that purely from a phenomenological point of view, this happens. People have this kind of experience. The disciples had some kind of experience like this, in all likelihood, after Jesus died. To what extent it resembled my friend's father appearing him, telling him to wear the suit, and to what extent it was like, you know, a radically different thing, is a big, long question. But I'm saying, again, going from the evidence we have, they did believe that Jesus appeared to them, and this galvanized them and led them to start a religion that claims the allegiance of a third of humanity.
Yeah, and the, you know, sort of interesting question then is that, like, okay, if we can't turn to scholarship to know exactly what is true and what is not, and we can maybe just get a sense of a general core story that we can accept, what do we do? I mean, as readers, as people who are, let's say, religious, interested in the story for whatever reason, their own spiritual seeking, their own version of Christianity, how do you then approach this text? It makes the text suddenly very enigmatic. It's like, I can't really believe it, but there's something here. What do I do with it? Do I just drop it? Do I just decide one version, like, I like the Zen Jesus, so I'm going to stick with that one? You know, it kind of raises an interesting problem for people who are reading not just for historical reasons, but for some kind of search for meaning.
Yes, that's true. But I want to back up to one thing you said at the beginning of your question just now. I am actually not questioning the value of scholarship, even in terms of the Old Testament. I'm sorry, New Testament. I am saying that many of the New Testament scholars are not applying their own criteria consistently or intelligently or honestly. I think the criteria that they're starting with are reasonable. That is to say, the age of a source and the multiplicity of sources are two key things that you have to consider in evaluating its authenticity. I'm saying scholars throw this out the minute it's convenient for them. So I'm not deriding scholarship, but I am saying scholars need to be more intellectually honest, particularly about the New Testament. Now, to go back to the second part of your question, it is the case that a lot of it is simply not true, literally true. Now, this has always been known. In fact, one of the earliest pieces of evidence is from the church father Origen in the 3rd century AD, who said, very, very many mistakes have been made because people have not understood that not all of these things happen. Even many of the things in the Gospels are not literally true. Now, Origen was sidelined by the church many centuries after his death, but that theme that there are several layers of meaning, that the literal level does not exhaust these levels of meaning, and that in many cases the literal level is not what happened. That idea has pervaded the history of both Judaism and Christianity from at least the 1st century to the present. And that is kind of where we're going to have to go. There are, for example, like all esoteric traditions, esoteric Christianity holds that there are different levels of the human being. The traditional ancient view was that the human being was tripartite, consisting of the body, soul, and spirit. What the difference is between the soul and spirit is another long subject. But there were these three levels of humanity, the human being, and the Bible spoke to each of these in different ways and in different capacities. Some of it was allegorical. That is to say, this is kind of a story about, you know, how to be a good person or what one kind of virtue and vice brings you some situation. Others, are more elaborately mystical. I mentioned these three levels, the body, soul, and spirit. Well, there are symbols for these three levels in the New Testament, and they are stone for the body, water for the soul, and wine for the spirit. So you get to the wedding at Cana. Jesus has them draw water out of stone cisterns. Water comes out of a stone, and he changes it to wine. This is, I believe, a reference to transformation and illumination at three different levels. So then suddenly, it becomes rather important whether this miracle happened, and B, it becomes more personally important because it might actually have to do with us and something that a process that either is happening or could happen in us. So that's a very simple example. And, there's an enormous amount. The Zohar, which is the great Kabbalistic work in many volumes written in the 13th century, in 13th century Spain mostly, is about that. It is an esoteric interpretation of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the Old Testament. Swedenborg, who was a great Swedish visionary of the 18th century, did his own equally voluminous account of the inner meanings of scripture. And so this just has gone on and on. This is a tradition that has persisted. I personally like to think it is continued unbroken or more or less unbroken, but that would be a thing that would require a lot of research and evidence to prove.
But what I like about it is it really shows the way in which a kind of esoteric worldview, meaning, let's see, a world where you acknowledge different dimensions of reality, that there are experiences that can bring you into contact with these different dimensions, and that there's some way of encoding this almost necessarily in an ambiguous form, because it can't be literal in the same respect, because the very worldview isn't literal. It's about how the world is both literal and metaphoric and cosmic and mystical. And that mind frame, which, you know, can seem very arcane to a lot of modern people, is actually a way to sort of, I won't say save, but sort of allow us to engage these texts in a rich way that allows them to speak and stimulate contemporary searching and seeking and finding, while also respecting the kinds of criticisms that that hardcore critical scholarship brings as well, because your faith isn't, or your interest in the text, your engagement with the text isn't threatened by the idea that a lot of it isn't historically accurate, because you're already in a world where there's a realm of history and then a realm of allegory, a realm of mystical kinds of forces. So in a way, esotericism, which can seem very arcane, is very practical when it comes to how do we engage these texts in light of the new knowledge that we have of them, without just writing them off as you know, useless fairy tales from the past.
Well, I agree with everything you said. The one thing I feel the need to add is that we are talking about interiority here. Internal experience, internal levels of the spirit and of the divine, which are real. People have them. Sometimes you can, a lot of people have them without ever having asked for them or wanted them. But opening yourself up to all of this requires some interest in interiority. And we live in a society now where interiority is almost completely flattened out. You know, it is completely a flat land of focus on the externals, the short term, you know, the immediate that we can see and feel and touch. And this is a complex historical phenomenon, a sociological phenomenon, but there's not a lot of, shall we say, widespread social encouragement for this kind of journey. And once you start, you know, that you may have occasionally a bit of a feeling of going it alone, although I would say that may not be as true as it looks.
Yeah, no, I can relate with what you're talking about. I mean, that's one of the things that I've been trying to do in this podcast is engage a wide variety of contemporary experiences and things people are doing, like in it really seize the day in terms of what's happening in our world, but to always kind of recognize that dimension, what you're calling interiority or a kind of attention to experience and the deep sense of the term, and how they're keep a place open for that. It can be pretty distressing when you look outside of it. And one sign of that, I think, is also the weird literalism that is in the that is in some esoteric material, meaning that you know, there's books about, you know, the Bible code, that if you, you know, use a certain coding way of interpreting the words and replacing them with numbers, which is, you know, of course, an old esoteric technique as well. But instead of opening up the text into these multiple levels that invite our own interiority, instead they become really literalized themselves. So there's just one code, and it, and the, you know, the Whore of Babylon is the Catholic Church, or it's the UN, or it's the EU, or whatever it is. There's some kind of weird, it's like a twofold movement. On the one hand, it recognizes that the text is not literal in the sense that it's rooted in its historical time. It's open to the future, which is a very exciting thing, because that means it's open to the, to us. But at the same time, they close off that openness by making it be really literally prophesying some particular thing or referring to some particular thing, and not opening up to that ambiguity that's required for genuine interiority. If you're going to have interior experience based on reading or studying or entering into a tradition, you have to go through a place of ambiguity where you're not really sure what it's meaning, you're not really sure if you're interpreting correctly. But we open up that possibility and then close it right away with the Bible code and all the stuff you see on the History Channel. And, you know, this kind of like pop, esoteric, pop, you know, hermetic kind of ways of reading biblical tradition and UFOs and the whole thing. So it's a very strange moment, because on the one hand, an aspect of the esoteric is very visible, and then on the other hand, perhaps a more refined dimension of the esoteric, a more interior dimension of it, is almost lost in terms of at least the way that it represents in popular culture. I'm curious how you see that, like even just looking at it from the 90s forward, from when we first started working for Gnosis, how the popularization of an aspect of the esoteric has shifted the whole meaning of trying to find these deeper dimensions of the self and experience through these traditions.
Well, to look at it on the positive side, it certainly means that people understand that there's something behind the literal meaning. It's obviously an intuitive understanding, because there's not a lot of external validation for it. But when someone comes out with something like the Bible code, you know, which treats basically the Torah as almost like, you know, a string of digits that can, you know, disclose certain meanings. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't hold up too well, because if it is a string of digits whose order and is significant, the text of the Hebrew Bible is not what was written. It has been changed. And if you're looking at it from a mathematical point of view, if you change even one, let's put it this way, if you change even one unit in a digital sequence, you're changing everything and screwing it up. And that's kind of what happens if you use the Bible code in that way. Now, you mentioned this use of this number mysticism, which is called gematria. That is to say, letters. And this was true in Hebrew and Greek, because numbers did double duty. Letters did double duty as numbers as well. People would add up the value of given names and derive equivalencies from them. People did this and do this. I would say this is legitimate, but in a way that is not quite the way it's usually understood. A lot of these contemplative devices, like gematria, have what I would say are an operational meaning. That is to say, there is no factual information that these kind of correlations necessarily convey. In fact, you can come up with so many different results that they really oughtn't or won't or shouldn't. But by making this kind of contemplative connection of all these things, these adding of numbers and this is connected to that, you change your own state of mind. The meaning has to do with the connections made in your own mind. let's talk about neuroplasticity. You know, the idea is that, you know, you can change your brain by changing the way you think, you know, simplistically put. Well, this kind of contemplation, I think, is meant to impart a certain kind of neural change to the mind, the brain, even without, you know, deciding, well, X is definitely Y, as if it were, you know, a code cipher.
Yeah, that seems to be a key. I mean, and it really has to do with, you know, if you broaden this issue a little bit in terms of interpretation, what you're talking about is that you have to accept and tolerate a certain kind of ambiguity, meaning you don't let your mind collapse the possible meanings to one literal truth. And at the same time, you have to still be open to the possibility, even the likelihood, that there's some profound meaning in this very operation. And this applies not only to something, you know, for most of us, very arcane like gematria, but also just how people interpret contemporary events. You know, there's everywhere you turn, there's a conspiracy theory ready for you to, you know, latch on to, if you so choose. And yet we're also in a moment when we can't help but surf different viewpoints of what's going on, what's actually going on beneath the surface. Is this propaganda? Is this spin? You know, there's this profound crisis in trust, trusting the media, trusting science, and people faced with that profound ambiguity often tend to literalize because it's more psychologically satisfying to have your answer. And so you find, and then those guys go off and then they believe, they have their conspiracy theory. It's about chemtrails, it's the flat earth, it's the lizards or whatever, or more reasonable kinds of conspiracies. But if you really look at how they got there, a lot of times it's that they were facing a rich ambiguity of possibilities, knowing that there's truth in there, perhaps, you know, somewhere. And rather than kind of deal with the ambiguity and the way that the ambiguity makes demands on you as an individual, as a single mind, as an evolving consciousness, rather than doing that, they collapse it into a literal truth, and then they start broadcasting it so that it just perpetuates the cycle. And to me, that's partly why it's at this point in history when there's so much conspiracy theory, which is a problematic term we could talk about, but there's so many conspiracies, and indeed they're more and more, and they're more available and visible and really affecting mainstream politics, ways we think about science, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, there's a spiritual crisis there too that has to do with the willingness to be open and sincere within a certain kind of ambiguity and a certain kind of lack of definition between the historically true and the esoterically true.
Yeah, and without taking these conspiracy theories literally or terribly seriously, you can also see a certain germ of truth in some of them. For example, the lizard people that you mentioned. Well, do I believe in this race of lizard people? No, I don't. By the way, reptiles are not an alien life form. They've been here for 300 million years. So if anything, we're the aliens. But if you just look at the news, pick the source you like, it's very, very easy to get the impression that many of the most powerful people in the world are only being governed by their reptilian brains. Specific names will not be mentioned. You know, that is to say, you know, a great deal of many of the powerful people in history are operating from their lowest impulses and seem to be aware of no others. This is unfortunately more true now than it was 10 or 15 years ago for reasons, you know, who knows. So without wanting to buy that into that myth, I mean, in a way, it's one of those myths that has a truth underneath it that I'm willing to contemplate. But in general, one thing I would say is I quote an old esoteric maxim very frequently in my books, and it's neither accept nor reject. That is to say, if you're willing to look at this possibility and contemplate it and turn it around in your mind without having to drop it either into the yes box or the no box, but you can just let it sit there, I think you're well ahead of the game. And if you let it sit there, it might give you some insights into something completely different later on. Again, it's integrating your neural system rather than bifurcating it.
That's wonderful. That's a great way of describing that kind of ambiguity that I'm talking about, or that tolerance for ambiguity, which doesn't mean giving up on the search for truth by any means, but it does involve that sort of holding for things and allowing those resonances, like the lizard brain, to you know, have their own say without completely collapsing the phenomenon to truth or ignoring it as just the babbling of crazy folk. We're going to have to wrap it up there. So I just wanted to thank you, Richard, for joining us again on Expanding Mind.
Well, it's been a pleasure as always. It's always good to talk to you, and I hope the listeners will enjoy it.
Great, great. And Richard's new book, by the way, again, is How God Became God, What Scholars Are Really Saying About God and the Bible. And like all of his books, it's fun to read. It's not too long. And so it really is responding to the needs of contemporary readers in a very smart and esoterically informed way. So check it out. With no further ado, keep your minds open.